counsel for appellant please proceed?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing the appellants, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you, counsel.
The district court should have dismissed this case under the Ferris Doctrine. Adjudicating plaintiff's claims would improperly require the court to second-guess the results of the military's own extensive investigation of plaintiff's claims, which found no basis for discipline. Moreover,
what was the result of that investigation? I'm having a hard time finding exactly what the findings were and what, if any, discipline was meted out as a result of that investigation. Maybe you can educate me on that.
Your Honor, no discipline was issued at all as a result of the investigation. And in the Senate's separate investigation of this of plaintiff's claims, which was in response to General Hyten's nomination to be Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson testified that as a result of the investigation, he was falsely accused.
Well, let's expand on that, because it seems to me that when you do the analysis under the Ferris Doctrine, it seems to me we have to presume, because it's a 12B motion, right? We have to presume that Colonel Spletztoser, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that we have to presume the truth of what she's alleging. And I have no antagonism towards the Ferris Doctrine, and I think I completely understand why it's necessary. So I'm going to start with that. But that being said, when you do the analysis, and what we have left is the act that occurred off base after this conference in her room, and we have, I think the specifics are alleged, the fact that she was found to be untruthful in the military investigation, and the fact that the Senate still went ahead and confirmed her, while not unanimously, they obviously went ahead and confirmed the general. Does that really even factor in to the Johnson analysis when we look at it, the fact that the military thought she was a liar, okay? Doesn't she get a chance to go to, if in fact when you go through things that occurred off base, what was their relationship, what are all of those type of things, if we found that Ferris didn't cover that one act, if she goes to civil court, she loses, but I don't believe those other things. I'm trying to figure out how, it seems to me you're trying to tell me, hey, the military thinks she's a liar, the Senate thought she was a liar, so because she's a liar, the Ferris Doctrine applies.
So, Your Honor, there are three elements to our Ferris argument. The first is the one I've identified, and just to draw back, as you know, this court and the Supreme Court has held the Ferris incident to service analysis is governed by a totality of the circumstances test.
It's very fact-specific. It's very fact-specific.
And again, three elements, Your Honor. First, the Supreme Court has held that Ferris, one of the core purposes of Ferris, is to prevent courts from inappropriately second-guessing military decisions. That's the Johnson case itself, which I know you're familiar with, that's the Supreme Court's most recent Ferris decision. In that case, there were service members who were on a military mission, and even though they did not allege any military negligence at all, they alleged negligence on the part of a civilian person, air traffic controller, the Supreme Court applied Ferris. And when you look at why it did that because it said the suit could have second-guessed military decisions. So I think that's an element in the analysis. It's not the only element, but it's a very important element. The second element is from the Shearer and Stanley cases.
Can we pause for a moment so we can get the clock? I have 13 minutes, 11 seconds. What do you have, Blanca? Oh, okay. All right. Is the clock working?
May I continue? Okay.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
So second element is that those cases emphasize that to allow that kind of second guessing would adversely impair the military mission by requiring service members to testify in court and compelled depositions, trial testimony. And here, I think the extensive nature of the military's own investigation is relevant for that reason as well. As our briefs explained, the military...
Let me see what I can focus this. Are you telling me that there are no circumstances under which a sexual assault claim can be litigated in civil court if it's brought against a general or a member of the service? Is there a line to be drawn here someplace? Or is it your position that under no circumstances can a sexual harassment case ever surface in a civil court proceeding if it's against the general or any officer?
Your Honor, that's not our argument at all. We've made the argument about the inappropriateness of second-guessing military judgments. When you have this kind of investigation, the military interviewed 63 witnesses in three countries.
The investigation cancels out any right or remedy somebody would have to go to a civil court to have an adjudication of her rights. Just the fact that there's an investigation, and that's the end of the game. Let me ask you this. If this were to be a civil trial, would even the results of that investigation be admissible in evidence?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. But again, our argument is not that that's the end of the day. And our third element, I should say, is that the plaintiff's own allegations confirm that this incident, which again, General Hyten denies, was incident to military service. Could I just go over a few of
those? Well, how could sexual assault ever be incident to military service? And my understanding is the reason he wasn't disciplined is because they didn't believe her. They didn't believe it happened. If the military had believed that what she's alleging had happened, wouldn't they have disciplined her? Or would they say that it's okay for a general to go to, if they believed her, that he went to her room, that he sexually assaulted her, would they wouldn't discipline if they believed her?
Well, Your Honor,
how could that ever be incident to military service?
Your Honor, the Ferris Doctrine does not focus on whether the alleged activity serves a military purpose. In fact, in cases like United States versus Shearer, that was a murder case. While a murder of one service member by another never serves the military mission, the question is whether it arose out of sexual.
Excuse me, I have to interrupt, my apologies, but the problem I'm having is that are you saying that a sexual assault is never incident to military service? I don't understand your position. When would sexual assault be incidental to service? When not be incidental to military service? Can you give me some sort of dichotomy and draw a line here so I can understand this better?
So absolutely, Your Honor. Again, as our briefs point out, the key facts here is alleged by the plaintiff, is that General Hyten and the plaintiff were on an official military trip to a military conference. They were on temporary duty status. She alleges that she was invited to the event because of her military service. She alleges that General Hyten was her military superior and that he misused his military authority by coming to
her room. That means he can sexually assault her. So that means that he can sexually assault her. Is that your position?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And this is the importance of the military's investigation. What the Ferris Doctrine is about is what is the appropriate vehicle for holding service members responsible for alleged conduct like this, which again, General Hyten denies. And the Johnson case, the Shearer case.
So if they had believed her, counsel, if they had believed her, he would have been held accountable, is what you're saying. If they had believed her. You're not saying sexual assault is incident to military service. Are there circumstances? See, I could see other things. Let's say, for example, I can't go into my law clerk's office and because she doesn't have her bench memo done, I can't throw a book at her, I can't scream at her, I can't slap her down in her chair. But if, let's say, I could see there would be situations in the military where someone was making life and death situations, it was dangerous, that you could grab someone, you could throw them down, you could do any number of things, and it wouldn't be for a court to second guess what they had to do in those circumstances. But I'm having a hard time figuring out when sexual assault would ever be incident to military service. It seems to me here they didn't believe her. So tell me, is there a time that sexual assault is incident to military service?
So let's take it like this.
Could you answer that question?
Can you answer that question? Is there a time that sexual assault is incident to military service?
No.
Okay.
And that's not our argument. That's not the question.
So don't we have to analyze whether the incident that occurred at the hotel, we go through the Johnson factors, and if the Johnson factors favor the military here, then the investigation, even though she didn't prevail, would be sufficient, and it would be covered by the Ferris Doctrine. But if we see the Johnson factors differently here, then she gets to go to civil court on the one sexual assault, even though, obviously, and I'm going to ask, she obviously has credibility issues. I can see this. I'm a former prosecutor. I did sexual assault. She doesn't report it. She doesn't report it when he makes leadership claims against her, right? She doesn't report it then. It all comes about later, right?
Your Honor, we're saying that the Johnson factors to which you refer do show that this case falls within the Ferris Doctrine. For example, this incident she alleges happened in a hotel room. Well, the hotel, she herself alleges that Stratcom used hotel rooms while on temporary duty trips like this one for military meetings. She alleges that also occurred after hours. And she alleges that General Hyten came to her room under the pretense of military purposes. So basically, according to her, her supervisor went to a location where she was on.
Okay, but the facts that we have to presume true, is there any indication they discussed any work in the record on the facts that we have to presume true? What do we have to presume true under 12B?
I don't believe she specifically alleges whether they actually discussed work or not, but I don't think that matters. Again, her allegation is the general came to her room and wanted to talk to her about work-related purposes. That, along with the other allegations, clearly shows that the argument in her case is that he misused his military authority at a military conference in a location where she would not have been in that room had it not been for her activity in this military.
You're running out of time. I have a question I want to ask you. Are you familiar with the case of Lutz versus Secretary of the Air Force?
I am, Your Honor.
So in that case, didn't the Supreme Court say, or didn't we say, that not every action by one member of the armed services against another is incident to service? Didn't we say that in Lutz?
Absolutely, and that's correct, Your Honor. And
all right. So doesn't that mean then we have to determine whether or not the particular action being alleged is or is not incident to service?
Yes, and this is incident to service for the same reasons that Lutz distinguished Stauber versus the United States, the case we think is controlling.
At 12 o'clock midnight, this is incident to military service?
Again, Your Honor, plaintiff herself alleges that Stratcom engaged in work-related activity in hotel rooms after hours at this conference.
But, counsel, the problem is you are blurring the background facts with the actual incident that's being used as the basis for the action. The discrete incident is the sexual assault. And so instead of looking at whether there is a backdrop of military, we need to look at the actual incident that's being complained of, and that's the sexual assault. And so we said in Lutz that not every action that's taken is incident to military service. Maybe the travel there, maybe the meeting there was incident to military service. If something had happened in conjunction with that meeting, we would have a different analysis. But we're looking at the discrete act of sexual assault, and I'm having a difficult time understanding how you can explain that discrete incident as being incident to military service.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with the premise of the argument. As Judge Kyle,
well, I'm not arguing. I'm asking you a question.
I'm trying to give you an answer. The answer is
well, but you said the argument, and I did not argue. I asked you a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies for that. The Johnson factors focus on questions like what was the location, what was the duty status, Was the person on a military activity? And Judge Callahan, yourself, you decided the McConnell case. That was a case where somebody was injured water skiing on a military recreational program. And the fact that they were involved in a recreational program was sufficient to make it military service. And if that's the case, I can't imagine why attending a military conference wouldn't be.
Lutz did the same thing. It went through the background, but then it said they broke into her office after hours, opened her private mail, and disseminated it in an attempt to ruin her reputation. These were the discrete actions that were being alleged. It seems hardly possible. I had my own timer on. It seems hardly possible that this conduct arises out of or is incident to service. So in the Lutz case, it went directly to the actions that were being complained of.
Your Honor, in the Stauber case, this court applied the Ferris Doctrine to bar allegations that a service member followed another service member off base in his car, honking his horns and making to annoy the person, and then went to his house and drove back in front of his house off base in order to harass the person. This court applied Ferris to those allegations, and for the same reasons, and noted in particular that this flowed out of the fact that, unlike here, the people who did the alleged torts were not even the superior of the person.
Let's do a hypothetical. Let's say they were on deployment, and right, these two are in different branches of the military, but let's say they were on deployment and the facts were such that the general was her supervisor, and let's say that it occurred on a military base. And there was maybe at the officers' club or something along those lines, and something occurred in the bathroom at the officers' club or something along those lines. I can conceive of, even though the acts could be what you're the same here, that in weighing the Johnson factors, I could weigh those factors differently, and it wouldn't be saying that sexual assault is okay or is incident, but that the investigation of those matters and the military's determination of what actually happened would be necessary to accept that. But these facts are different than that. So I'm trying to, you know, it seems that the Ferris analysis is very fact specific, and I see the facts somewhat different in Stauber than what you're stating. So I'm guessing, what claims by a service member against another service member would not be barred by the Ferris Doctrine?
So if I could first try to make the point that I think the hypothetical you provided is exactly this case, according to plaintiff's allegations.
Well, I don't think it is, but that's stronger to me, and I would have an easier time understanding the application of the Ferris Doctrine than here, but it's not. I think they're not exactly the same, because one's during an deployment, one's a direct supervisor. It's occurring on the military base, and all that's different than they're in two branches of government. I guess he's higher ranked than she is. I don't know if you would characterize him as her direct supervisor. But it occurs in her hotel room after hours, not at the conference. And the conference isn't, there were civilians at the conference. They were invited to the conference because they were a part of, I think, STRATCOM, or however you say that. So they're not, I gave some really pretty strong facts where I wouldn't have a problem with the Ferris Doctrine, and it could be a sexual assault.
Well, let me try to answer it this way. We would not argue that Ferris bars the case. Let's say if just two unrelated service members who'd never met each other before happen to meet up in a bar and there's a sexual assault. So in that case, certainly Ferris would not apply. This case, I think, is different. I don't think it makes a difference that this was not a deployment, because temporary duty status is essentially a form of deployment. They've been deployed to this conference for official military business. And again, her own allegations, which you have to accept for purposes of ruling on this motion, is that this happened in a hotel room where she would not have been there except for her military status. And the StratCon did work in hotel rooms after hours at conferences like this one. He was her military supervisor. And the nub of her claim, again, is that he misused his authority in a context like this to engage in this activity. So that
is you're basically saying that a sexual assault can be incident to military service is what you're saying.
No, Your Honor. Again, the courts don't focus on the nature of the specific act. That's murder is not incident to service. Yet the Supreme Court in Scheer barred a case under Ferris in which one service member murdered another one. And in all these sexual harassment cases cited in our brief, in which the courts have time and again applied Ferris to bar sexual harassment, sexual assault cases. Corey versus United States is almost directly on point. There, a plaintiff alleged that she was sexually assaulted at a military party while she and the assailant were on temporary duty deployment to Turkey. And the court barred suit. And one final case in Stubbs versus the United States, the plaintiffs alleged that a drill sergeant ordered her to a latrine, ostensibly for work-related purposes, and then perpetrated a sexual assault there, and the court applied the Ferris Doctrine. So you don't focus on the fact that there was negligent or intentional activity. You focus on the Johnson factors. Where did it occur? Did it flow out of a military mission? What was the status at the time? And you have to take the plaintiff's allegations in this case, which again, General Hyten denies, but you have to take them as true. And they established themselves that the Ferris Doctrine applies.
All right, counsel, you far exceeded your time. We'll hear from the government, but we will give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the plaintiffs. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Arielle Solomon for Catherine Spletzdoser. The district court correctly held that the Ferris Doctrine does not preclude the court from exercising subject matter jurisdiction over her complaint, and the decision should indeed be affirmed. When the Supreme Court created Ferris, it could have barred all suits against the military, but it did not. And it did not because some behavior, some activity, irrespective of the actors that are involved, simply cannot be considered incident to military service. This case is an archetypal example of why Ferris was not meant to be a complete bar to suits against the military. Regrettably, my colleague has the distasteful job of convincing you to deny a sexual assault victim access to a civil court. In this endeavor, the government cites to precedent that is too factually distinct to draw an inference to the present case.
Well, I guess, do you agree that there could be some sexual assaults that could be barred by the Ferris Doctrine? Would you agree?
I agree that as a factor that the court considers when doing a Ferris analysis, all sexual assault should be a factor that counsels against application of a Ferris bar. It is the type of activity that is too distinct from military activity to be considered something incident to military service, which is exactly what this court said in the Lutz case. And that's the circumstances that we have here. In Lutz, this court held that when actions are completely separate from on-the-job-related activities, which is distinguishable from the Stauber case, the Stauber rationale does not apply. Like the court in Lutz, the district court here below could not fathom how a sexual assault in a private hotel room where civilians
What if it were on a deployment? What if it weren't necessarily a person that was that, you know, the facts were such that it was just a person of equal rank and something happened. And then the military did an investigation. And after the investigation, they didn't believe that a sexual assault had occurred. Couldn't the Ferris Doctrine bar filing a civil suit on that?
No, it could not. And I think that a case most similar to the question that you've posed, perhaps, at least in part, there was a couple of parts to that question, is an Eighth Circuit decision, the Stubbs case, which the government did cite in their brief, but they relied on extensively and brazenly at the district court below, involved someone being a subordinate being ordered to a latrine to clean.
But I didn't say a subordinate. I didn't say a subordinate. I said two equal people.
Two equal people. So if, so to the extent, and I'm, please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm understanding your question correctly, to the extent the question is, does the fact that General Hyten, that John Hyten is a four-star general, indicate that Ferez always should apply or counsels in favor of a Ferez bar? I think the answer here is no, because—
No, that wasn't her question. Her question was, if there are two people of equal rank, and there is
and they're on a deployment, they're in military facilities, and then there's an allegation of a sexual assault, and it's investigated, and the military determines that the person that made the allegations was either not credible or did not meet the burden, and so they chose not to discipline either of them. Isn't it possible that the Ferez Doctrine could bar that, even though it the allegations are that of a sexual assault?
I think the answer is no to that.
If the answer is no to that, then I don't really, then I don't like your rule, okay? That's I think for me to accept your argument, it has to be very fact specific, and it has to be very narrow. And if the government says that a sexual assault can never, is always regardless of the attendant facts going to be covered by the Ferez Doctrine, you heard there was some hostility towards that. And now if you're telling me a sexual assault allegation can never be subject to the Ferez Doctrine, I'm giving you some pushback on that.
I think that there are other factors. So again, I think that a sexual assault can always be a factor that counsels against application of the Ferez bar. That does not mean that there wouldn't be other factors involved, unfortunately, that would counsel in favor of application of the Ferez bar. So the case that I...
Let me interrupt in that respect, all right? You will agree that the Johnson analysis is what we must engage in. I assume you agree with that, correct?
Our position below was actually that the court needn't use Ferez, but Ferez is currently the prevailing law in the Ninth Circuit for state law claims. So if we're looking at the case law specifically in the circuit, the answer is that the Johnson factors is what the court should look at, with the caveat that the Johnson case did involve a negligence cause of action.
Let me ask this follow-up question. So let's just the Johnson factors are what we must engage in that analysis under Johnson. Do you think that the fact that there's a sexual assault in a more dominant way than the other factors, or what place you say the act of a sexual assault should have in analysis of the Johnson?
I apologize, Your Honor. It may be on my end, but the first part of the question broke up, and I did not hear the whole question.
I have some problems with the internet. The question is, first, we agree that Johnson is what we must engage in terms of making the Johnson analysis here. I think on the Ninth Circuit, that we're obliged to do. Do we agree with that? That's my first question. Did you hear that?
I did. And our position below was actually that the court could rely on the Westfall test for determining whether or not personal liability attaches. But to the extent we're using the Johnson factors, which is the prevailing case law in this circuit, then this is how we're analyzing the case for purposes of this argument.
And my follow-up question is, to what extent do we deal with sexual assault in the Johnson analysis? Should it be a more dominant factor? Should it be just one of the other factors? Does it have any special place to play in the Johnson analysis?
I think that much as the way the Lutz court analyzed the Johnson factors, They didn't call them specifically the Johnson factors, but they, of course, hit on each and every Johnson factor, that the fact that the behavior at issue, the conduct at issue, is so separate and apart from anything that is remotely related to the military mission or the purpose of this conference or attending to any assignments is indicative that Ferris shouldn't apply under those circumstances. But other factors would have to be considered in order to be brought in to look at whether or not Ferris applies.
Well, let me change the hypothetical. So let's say they're still at that location, they're at that conference, we know what they're, it's not disputed what their ranks were and all of that. But let's say that the general came over late at night when she was getting ready for bed, which we have to presume that to be true under this, and he yelled at her about certain things that she said at the conference that he thought were ridiculous, and let's say that he made comments, I'm going to use a quote because I wouldn't usually, your fat ass, quote unquote, was, you were disrespecting the military, you were stupid, you were this, all of those things. Now, arguably, if I went to my law clerk's room late at night and said those things, I think they would have a pretty good start to a hostile work environment. But if you change that it wasn't a sexual assault, that he's like screaming at her about how she behaved at the meeting and said derogatory things and made comments about her body and this, that, and the other, would that be Ferris barred?
I think, unfortunately, it would be Ferris barred, not because it should be, but because under the Ferris analysis that you've now linked the injury, the harassment that's happening specifically to the military conduct and the conference. Here, that's not what happened, right? The conference.
Okay, no, I understand that. I'm a little bit, you're asking for a really broad rule, and I'm a little bit happy that you understand that there are some limits. But that being said, I guess, do you think that there is a conflation going on that, obviously the military, I can't find out everything that was in the investigation, and I don't know that it's appropriate because we're on a 12B motion, that your client doesn't sound like she was believed for any number of factors, and either by he got confirmed, so some people might have believed it, but not enough believed it in order to, they went ahead and they confirmed him in this new position. There was no discipline. I don't know if this would have been adultery under military standards or whatever, but he doesn't get the general doesn't get disciplined for anything, so they don't believe your client. And as a former prosecutor, it seems to me that he accused her of leadership violations shortly after this incident, and it's going to come up in this trial that she doesn't ever mention this incident when he's accusing her of leadership violations. He wasn't really her direct supervisor, but and apparently there are, and I think they sustained a complaint against your client over her leadership style because she screamed and yelled at people or wasn't a very pleasant person, right? Something along those lines. So, but I guess, does that really matter here? I think you'll have to deal with all of that if you get to go forward, and you might very well lose, and those are things that if I were on the other side, I would certainly bring up about your client, but I don't think it has any place in the Ferris analysis. So I think you might have a weak case because of her failure to report, and even when he accused her of things, didn't say anything, the timing, all of those things are going to come up, right, if you go forward.
I agree with you that concerns about credibility should not factor into the Ferris analysis. And it is true that in a sexual assault case, credibility is always put at issue, just as in any right. sexual assault case. It'll always have to be dealt with. But the fact that someone did not believe my client is not indicative that they should be immune from suit in their personal capacity. So it has no place for purposes of this court's Ferris analysis.
Counsel, does the prior discipline...
Go ahead, Judge Block. So we're in a motion to dismiss phase right now. And if we were to affirm the case, we go forward, there will be depositions and there will be an opportunity to bring a motion for summary judgment when the record is fully developed. And I guess you...
I think Judge Block's frozen. He's frozen to us too, so we'll unfreeze him. Judge Block, you're frozen to us. We have to unfreeze you.
Oh, wow.
Could you repeat that question, Judge Block?
The question is that we're at a motion stage, and we have to analyze the Johnson doctrines in that context, de novo. But if we were to agree and affirm, then the case would go forward. There would obviously be depositions. There would be a full development of facts under oath. And at that particular time, either party can move, I guess, with summary judgment. And I imagine the Ferris Doctrine can be raised again at that particular point. So I just think from a procedural point of view, there's nothing that we need to be concerned about in terms of this particular stage. Am I correct about that or not?
I think that part of the court's analysis should be if litigation impacts military decision making or some military function. But here, the facts of this case, even assuming there's discovery and the case gets fully developed, is not going to implicate the kind of military decision making judgments that would normally be concerned with for purposes of a FARA's analysis.
Why doesn't that apply to the investigations that were done in this case? That's military decision making, isn't it?
And the court does not have to reach that question here, because in the first amended complaint, Catherine Spletsoser did not make any reference to the investigation. More specifically, she did not allege a claim for some type of negligent investigation or that the investigation was insufficiently done. However true that may be, it's not the subject of her claim that's against General Hyten.
But in doing the analysis under Johnson, don't we look at whether or not there's an effect to the workings of the military? Isn't that part of the Ferris Doctrine, that we're not to interfere with the governance of the military?
I think as a general matter, what you've just stated is correct, but the case particularly on point in this circuit is still the Lutz decision. So in the Lutz decision, right, we had against the Air Force, we had an Air Force complaint.
I know the facts of the Lutz case, but I'm asking you why, and these cases are very fact intensive. So I'm asking you, under the facts of this case, where there were two investigations that cleared the general, why doesn't that factor into our Ferris analysis?
I don't know that it could be fair to say that the investigations cleared.
Well, I would say that no discipline was imposed and he was nevertheless elevated to one of the highest positions in the land. So how do those investigations affect our analysis?
I think the fact that he was pushed through the confirmation process and eventually did take that political seat does not indicate that the court's going to be looking into the investigation. The Lutz case, as you're aware, said that when there's no military decision, decision to do nothing, in essence, the court is not infringing on a military decision when the decision is they're just not doing anything.
But they did something here. They did something here. And I think you also, didn't you take the position we should reconsider Lutz, which I don't see how we can do that here, but.
I think this circuit could reconsider Ferris specifically, not just the Lutz decision, but under the Westfall Act, Congress has specifically identified under what circumstances service members are going to be held personally liable to suit. And they've used a different test than the incident to service test. They've used a scope of employment test, which is of course different than the one that we're using here. So I think that particular statute could beg a different analysis in this circuit. And I don't think the circuit's been asked that question before, but under that particular statute, Congress has identified the test that should be used, and it's indeed a scope of employment test.
Are there any other questions? Do you have anything else, counsel?
No, I see that my time has elapsed. I'll just conclude briefly by saying that amid the universe demoralizing Ferris precedent and regretful circuit decisions, under the specific facts of this case, At this time, this circuit does not need to deny a sexual assault victim access to a civil court. So with that, I thank you, and I will rest on our briefs.
All right, thank you. Let's put 1 minute on the clock for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to be clear, even though plaintiff is no longer pursuing her original complaint claim challenging the military's investigation, there's no question that for the court to adjudicate this case would require the court to second guess the results of that that investigation, which was extensive. And because it was so expensive, again, what she's asking for is a duplication of what the military has done in interviewing all these different witnesses and looking at all the different evidence. And there's no question this would substantially deter and distract military officials from their
basically, your position is that if there's an investigation by the military, that trumps everything.
No, Your Honor, it's a totality of the circumstances test. That's one element, as I think the plaintiffs themselves have told you this morning. The other element is the plaintiff's own allegations show that this, if taken as true, that this was incident to service. This rose out of a military mission, alleged abuse of military authority. She was in this hotel room only because of her military service. Your Honor, my time has expired, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but I don't want to go over again.
Are there any questions? It appears not. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments in this challenging case. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court. That completes our calendar for the morning. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
This court stands in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.